name's David Kramer. I'm a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Anchorage, Alaska.
And I'm Joe Wegman. I, too, am a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Anchorage.
And, like, weather is such a big part of Alaskan life. You know, people, I feel like, of all cities I've lived in, they pay attention to weather, whether you're in the rural villages or on the high seas. Could you guys just go into, like, what your day-to-day looks like?
As far as the forecast goes, we'll start our day analyzing all of the weather forecast models, which each provide a potential outcome for what the weather may be over the next few days. And, of course, our goal is to pick the most accurate one, but there are many things in the models that don't resolve well, like local winds and stuff, funneling, that sort of thing. So even if you pick the best one, there's still plenty more to do to improve upon even that, and that's what we work on. We try to provide the best service we can above and beyond what can be accessed anywhere, and that's using local experience and our meteorological background.
Yeah, and we'll balance with a lot of things that we can see in real time as well, with satellite imagery or radar observations, any reports that we even get from mariners or pilots that we can use to incorporate into our process, and add all of that together to try to form our own weather picture. And we do it in a graphical format now, so we can cover large areas over time periods and get a total better picture of what's going on with the weather.
And so one of our goals with our trip here, besides the schoolwork and repairing weather stations, has also been to talk to the locals, especially mariners, and find out what it is that we're doing well, what we're doing poorly, and what we can improve upon, and any other local things that people who've lived here and worked here for a number of years would know that those of us who aren't locals wouldn't necessarily know.
What was some of the feedback you guys heard from locals and local mariners?
Yeah, some of it was pretty positive about how they use our products, what things that they use on a daily basis or use for a broader picture. And then we were learning some things, areas where maybe we're being too broad and can identify like local effects with how the channel terrain can eddy some of the winds around and change the way that our forecast can be read to get more of a exact picture of what's going on.
And then on top of that, for the mariners, we at one point had very large zones, sometimes 100 miles or more across, which can be useful if you're well out into the ocean, but doesn't necessarily work so well when you have coastal effects in mountains that can change the wind direction and cause funneling and stuff.
Yeah. And we also got some fun little local effect pieces of knowledge from some mariners who have been around a long time, and how areas even just with near island can impact the way that the winds are going and how strong they can be going as well.
Was there anything specific that they like shared with you that surprised you other than the near island funneling of the winds?
Well, I found a lot of people like to use that Windy TY app for seeing how the wind flow patterns go, and you can look at some of the same models that we use for developing our forecast too. I saw quite a bit of that, and at the same time, we also learned there's quite a few people that like to use our products that will call in for the weather forecast via our phone numbers. That we didn't necessarily know people were using those things or how many people were.
Yep, and just generally how weather savvy people in Kodiak just seem to be, how much information they have, how much of an understanding of their own local environment that there is, and can take some of the things that we do and they take it to that next level of how to apply it locally. And it's pretty amazing, especially like with those marine customers that use it daily, how much knowledge they have about weather in general and that base that we can build from with them with that.
And what else, other than speaking with locals about what products they use of the National Weather Services and also just like understanding of weather patterns in Kodiak, like what else brought you guys to the island?
So the initial reason was to help fix weather stations. We have several stations around Kodiak where dedicated observers will keep track of the high temperature, the low temperature, precipitation, and snowfall for each and every day. And we provide them a number of instruments through that program. But as you would know, after even a couple of years, given all the rain that Kodiak usually gets, that those instruments start to weather a bit. They will grow mold and things on them. And so there comes a point, rather than just the basic cleaning, where instruments, even though they may still be working, still need to be replaced so that you're getting the most accurate stuff. So it started out with as a trip like that, and then we decided, because the previous time I was here, the weather did not cooperate for allowing for the float plane to get there. So we decided it would be good to have a second day as an option for that, in case the weather's bad one day, maybe the next day will be better. So we've been going around to various schools, some of the elementary schools, the high school, and doing talks to educate the children about tsunamis primarily, because those warnings and stuff are issued through one of our partners at the National Tsunami Warning Center, which is up in Palmer. And so they, by talking and educating the students, we can help to have more people know what to look for in the event there may be a tsunami coming, and to help warn people to save lives and move to higher ground.
Yeah, so Tsunami Ready program, and Kodiak is one of our Tsunami Ready partners. So we were able to speak with some city officials like the fire chief and really see where the program is at. So we do yearly check-ins with Tsunami Ready program, and part of that, what we like to do is outreach to the schools. And people went to down to the Harbor Master and talked to them for a while about everything that they work with tsunami stuff and even storm-ready things as well, to try to get an idea. And doing the outreach and education is a big piece of that.
So what are some of the things that you talked about with these classrooms? Like, what are things people should know?
Tsunami is the most frequent cause of tsunamis that may impact Kodiak are from earthquakes. There is a fault line that lies just off the coast of Kodiak. And the last big event along that fault line was in 1964. And I'm sure everybody at all the schools had, especially the older ones, knew about that earthquake and resulting tsunami and how devastating it ended up being to not just Kodiak, but a number of villages all around the area. So in addition to educating on how tsunamis form, why they form, we also went into various safety steps that they can take to prevent the loss of life, dependent upon how strong the tsunami is. So you can look for things like the ocean retreating a longer way back than what you're used to and from just a low tide. And that is a single thing you can look for to know that there's a tsunami coming. For earthquakes, they should an earthquake that's strong enough to create a tsunami generally lasts about 20 seconds. And so when you're shaking, you don't necessarily, unless you have a watch, you don't necessarily know how fast 20 seconds goes. We were teaching the kids about use one Mississippi or one spaghetti or whatever you want to space out those seconds so you don't count so fast. And then they know if it gets to 20 seconds or more that it's time to start moving inland, even if you haven't yet heard the tsunami siren.
How far, how high or far away from the shore do y'all usually recommend that residents go?
So I know in Kodiak that it used to be the 100-foot mark is what we looked for, but I know that a lot of those inundation maps are getting redone, so some of that may be changing in the future here. UAF is working with Kodiak to do some of that. So at this point, we don't necessarily have an exact number that we go by. It's more get as far inland as you can, get as high as you can, as fast as you can, because we learned even in 2011 with the Japan tsunami, we used to say get a mile inland. Well, that tsunami went in 10 miles in some places, so we're kind of steering away from some of those exact numbers and going more towards the mapping, because even in some channeled bays and stuff, the waves could get higher than it would in particular other areas. So single height for the whole area we're not going to necessarily go for, but get as far as you can, get as high as you can, and especially if you're if you're able to drive around, move around, or working in different locations, know those inundation maps and know how far the water could possibly get in one of those really big earthquake tsunami situations.
In a tsunami situation, like in 1964, a lot of boats were thrown. And not that if you're out on the water, your boat's going to get thrown, but what should fishermen do if they're out on the water during an earthquake and it's longer than 20 seconds?
Yeah, that becomes a really interesting situation because some of it can depend on where the tsunami originated from. If it is a Japan one or Cascadia fault line down by Washington, you're going to have a lot of time. You're going to have 6 to 10 hours to kind of figure out what you want to do. If you are already out on the water in some situations, it may be safer to stay out there. If you're on land, I know some people want to save their boats, but we would probably recommend just get to higher ground, and we can worry about that later, but let's worry about saving people's lives first. Sometimes if it's really close, you're not going to have time to really do anything. If you're on your boat, that's where you're going to be. And UAF is doing a lot of research in currents around the area. So if you can find those charts and maps that I think they have at City Hall here, you can see where the different currents will set up, and there's some areas with some lower currents, some null areas, if you will, where you can kind of get away from that. Otherwise, you want to get to deep water. I think the threshold that we've been using is around 100 fathoms. So if you know where those areas are, that's also going to be a lot safer. Those more shallow locations are going to have the stronger currents, which can be really dangerous.
Keep in mind, too, with if you are on a boat or plan to take the boat out, if assuming that the earthquake that's causing the tsunami is far away enough that you can reach 100 fathoms without without trouble from the tsunami, that the tsunamis create a lot of currents. They're very strong. A one-foot tsunami moves in inland a much further distance than a one-foot wind wave that you would normally see on the beach. They have a lot of energy. And so both when the tsunami is coming in and when that water is receding, you're creating lots of currents that aren't normally there. And they can be strong enough to hold a boat to essentially not moving, even going at full throttle if you're trying to get away from the current. So, and because these currents can sometimes last for hours, days even, it's possible that if you don't have enough supplies on your boat to last a number of days because all the harbors around here may be closed due to those same currents, that there, you could be in trouble even being out on the boat and not having to deal with all the damage and debris, but just simply from a lack of ability to come back inland. So we definitely recommend those who choose to take their boat out or are out on the boat at the time to have a long supply of food and water in case in the event that happens.
So like in a sense, like if you're going to go on the water around Kodiak, you should always have that kind of emergency kit of food and water because you can't really predict when tsunamis will happen, correct?
Exactly, yeah. And even with storm-ready stuff for traveling around town, having some kind of emergency kit in your car and having supplies at your home because the next volcano could happen and any number of weather patterns can shift where you can be without electricity for days at a time. And having those supplies at your home, on your boat, in your car, even when you go hiking, having extra clothing, extra layers, gloves, hat, all that kind of stuff, very important. And that should be at any of those locations where you could find yourself at.
And after speaking with like the harbor master and the chief of the fire department in Kodiak, how do you guys feel this community is prepared?
Kodiak does an excellent job. I've been really impressed with what we've seen around with the knowledge that people in Kodiak have for storm ready, tsunami ready, the just weather patterns and knowledge in general. And I know that there's a lot of things still that they are working towards to make things even better with getting those new inundation maps and how we can change some things in the city about how we look at tsunami threats and evacuation plans and stuff like that.
And in general, like when you're talking to these kids or just someone on the street, where do you tell people to turn to look for a tsunami warning?
There's many different avenues to get them. I mean, the main one that people hear about every Wednesday at 2 p.m. is those sirens going off. So especially if it's not Wednesday at 2 p.m. and you hear those sirens, be very aware and start taking action to make your way to higher ground. Know where you're at. You can see the blue signs around town, those tsunami hazard zones. If you're in one of those and you're in an earthquake that's 20 seconds or longer, you need to get out of there. You can also hear on TV there could be scrollers coming in for a tsunami warning. You could hear if you have a NOAA weather radio, and we would recommend getting a battery-powered radio to have in case of an emergency like volcanoes, tsunamis, and stuff, so that you don't have to rely on your normal electricity and connections through that. But battery-powered radio and NOAA weather radio. You can get things on your cell phone that will alert you to tsunamis in danger like that. Normal TV broadcasters will be talking about that kind of stuff too. So there's many different ways that you can get tsunami information on the tsunami website as well.
Oh, do you guys know when the last time Alaskan community was struck by a tsunami? Was it 1964?
Well, so all the ones like Japan 2011, I mean, the tsunami did get here. Now, when those far away ones, a lot of times the biggest impacts are just in the marine location. So maybe if you were on your boat, you get in those stronger currents and you notice it happens if you're at the harbor at the time. Not a lot of the ones generated far out like that are going to get right into a lot, like on land like the 64 one did. So as far as really big ones that had a lot of structural damage, knocking over houses, moving boats on land for Alaska, was probably the 64 quake. But we have had tsunamis impact Alaska. Again, it's just mostly in the marine areas.
That's really interesting. I guess I just, like, I never imagined the currents that come with those, like such a moving so much water, but it makes total sense. And it's really interesting that the currents from the Fukushima tsunami wave could have affected Alaskan mariners.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the waves were bouncing back and forth through the Pacific Ocean for over a week, and those currents were impacting especially the harbors, and like in California and stuff, they had big problems with that. The currents were so strong that they had a lot of the harbors closed for at least the better part of that week. And in the open ocean, I mean, tsunamis move really fast, 500 miles an hour. And they get a little bit slower when they get towards land, around 30 miles an hour. But you can imagine the currents with that, especially you get those eddying effects and whirlpools and stuff that can cause a lot of problems.
Yeah, especially if you consider that for as far as currents go, the natural currents that are the strongest, such as the Agulhas Current on the south end of Africa or the Gulf Stream on the east coast of the U.S., they are moving at 1 or 2 miles per hour at most, and that's considered a really strong current for one that lasts essentially forever. So when you have a tsunami moving in at 30 miles per hour and generating currents that can reach to that speed, you see the big difference of how difficult it may be to get around if you're stuck in that current.
When talking to like children about tsunamis, like as an adult, I find them terrifying. So how did you guys take on the subject with children or young adults in a way that would allow them to be more prepared for them rather than scaring them?
Yeah, a lot of it is teaching about general safety rules and rules of thumb with it. How long do you keep, or when the earthquake happens, how do you stay safe? You get under your desk, make sure that you protect your head from things falling if the ceiling tiles are breaking or lights are falling or whatnot. But teaching them about how the different waves can be, even though it's only a foot high, what it can be like with the different speeds, and having them like work through different things of what things can sound like, what they can look like, or what they can feel like to get a different sense of what we're looking for to be aware of a tsunami coming. And we're trying to keep it a lot of times on the safety focus side about what they're identifying and what they can do. And not necessarily showing them big tsunamis in Japan, knocking down buildings and throwing cars around.
Yeah, it's important to recognize, too, that earthquakes, especially the big ones, are scary. That's the nature of what they are. And it's perfectly natural to be scared of the next one or when it will happen. But the key with our trip down here is for education purposes. And if those who are in an earthquake understand what's going on, what signs to look for, and stuff like that, then they'll be much more prepared and they don't have to panic every time a an earthquake happens or fear that a tsunami will happen with any earthquake. They only happen with specific ones that have to be a certain strength, at least 7.0, to generate an earthquake that's at least 20 seconds long. So you become less afraid if you know what to do ahead of time. And that's what our goal was.